Let's get started with the opening prayer. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Beloved David,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. Give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace. Bliss. Amen. Let's do a short meditation. I think you'll like this. I'm going to go ahead and show the screen to most of you will probably want to meditate, but it's quite beautiful. Chanting, a family chanting.
Suspense, but evil, Lord.
My reading from the Bible is from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, starting with verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor, which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. But the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. The preacher was king over Israel in Jerusalem. It says, I, the preacher, was king over Jerusalem, over Israel in Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised with therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with mine own heart, saying, Lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. And from the autobiography of a yogi, a short description of what it was like to be with Babaji by Lahiri Maharshi after first meeting him. My son, Babaji said, embracing me. So this is the remembrances of Lahiri Maharshi as told to Swami Kevalananda and Swami Sri Yukteswar. And Master wrote this, combining all the things he knew about this great meeting. And he puts it in the words of Lahiri Maharshi. My son, Babaji said, embracing me, your role in this incarnation must be played on an outward stage, prenatally blessed by many lives of lonely meditation. You must now mingle in the world of men. A deep purpose underlay the fact that you did not meet me this time until you are already a married man with modest business responsibilities. You must put aside your thoughts of joining our secret band in the Himalayas. Your life lies in the crowded marts, serving as an example of the ideal yogi householder. The cries of many bewildered worldly men and women have not fallen unheard on the ears of the great ones, he went on. You have been chosen to bring spiritual solace through Kriya Yoga to numerous earnest seekers. The millions who are encumbered by family ties and heavy worldly duties will take new heart from you, a householder like themselves. You must guide them to see that the highest yogic attainments are not barred to the family man. Even in the world, the yogi who faithfully discharges his responsibilities without personal motive or attachment treads the sure path of enlightenment. No necessity compels you to leave the world, for inwardly you have already sundered its every karmic tie. Not of this world, you must yet be in it. Many years still remain during which you must conscientiously fulfill your family, business, civic, and spiritual duties. A sweet new breath of divine hope will penetrate the hearts of worldly men. From your balanced life, they will understand that liberation is dependent on inner rather than outer renunciations. How remote seemed my family, the office, the world, as I listened to my guru in the high Himalayan solitudes. Yet adamantine truth rang in his words. I submissively agreed to leave this blessed haven of peace. Babaji instructed me in the ancient rigid rules which govern the transmission of the yogic art from guru to disciple. Bestow the Kriya key only on qualified chelas. Chelas are disciples. Babaji said, he who vows to sacrifice all in the quest of the divine is fit to unravel the final mysteries of life through the science of meditation. Angelic guru, as you have already favored mankind by resurrecting the lost Kriya art, will you not increase that benefit by relaxing the strict requirements for discipleship? I gazed beseechingly at Babaji. I pray that you permit me to communicate Kriya to all seekers, even though at first they cannot vow themselves to complete inner renunciation. The tortured men and women of the world, pursued by the threefold suffering, need special encouragement. They may never attempt the road to freedom if Kriya initiation be withheld from them. And Babaji says, be it so. The divine wish has been expressed through you. With these simple words, the merciful guru banished the rigorous safeguards that for ages had hidden Kriya from the world. Give Kriya freely to all who humbly ask for help. After a silence, Babaji added, repeat to each of your disciples this majestic promise from the Bhagavad Gita. Even a little bit of practice of this religion will save you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. So Kriya has been much on my mind lately. And so the first reading was from Ecclesiastes. It's the reading the mother always appointed to, as showing that the Kriya breath, the circuit that is made in the Bible, wind is breath. And the points of the going from the north to the south and the south to the north and whirling about is also, the mother had read that many times, in fact. And so I thought it was appropriate to read it tonight. But I read it. It's quite surprising how much it's talking about the physical world and the physical state that we all live in. That it's all vanity. You know, I started thinking what that meant. You know, that vanity is that which is associated with the lower ego, that which has invested in this world. And listen to some of these things he says. Says, what profiteth hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Now, Mother always insisted that this is talking about the body. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. But the earth abideth forever, the earth being the physical world and the body within it, and the constraints associated with that. But he says, well, and here's the quote that Mother always did read, if not the rest of this. The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. And, of course, the Kriya practice has to do with the breath control and to directing the energy within the spine through those circuits. But Mother always said, too, that this next line, all the rivers run into the sea. The sea is the spine, is the Sushumna passage, and it's the where all things come into the knowledge of the brain. Yet the sea is not full unto the place where from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied, the ear filled with hearing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. This is the realm of the physical earth, the earthly realm, physical plane. And things are stable here. No, nothing new comes into the realm. If you think about the three bodily jars, within each jar is the water of the ocean. But the jar confines that water to be separated from the rest of the ocean, immersed into the astral ocean, and then the astral ocean or astral plane is immersed into the causal, and the causal into the great unknown, the great void. But these things are not stale so much, but they are stable, and they've not, and nothing happens, nothing new. Only new things can come from God, and only new things can come from the Spirit. All the new that's in this world is already created. And so we only spend time learning the things that are here. It's quite, I won't say chilling, but it's quite constricting to in your mind to think that this has been done many times. There's no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. So even the memory isn't important, certainly. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. Now, Mother had a much better understanding than I'm able to remember, and she did talk about some of these things, but very rarely on this, these later lines from this scripture. And she has, we probably can find it in Mother's transcripts, some more details on this. But what amazes me is that is the static nature here. And here's the key to, I gave my heart, this is the second to the last line, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So we think of Adam and Eve learning the knowledge of good and evil. What does it profit you? So in the terms of getting things clear, what we are doing, this is very, very high talk. This is the talk of a taught to people who are being saved, who are being given enlightenment and given complete release from all the bodily jars. And so this is phrased and framed in a negative way by saying, you know nothing. Anything you do know will be nothing but vexation anyway. Nothing here is new. It's been created a long time ago. And there is change of the outer form, but the actual lessons you can learn here are very limited. And then we have the story of Babaji bringing Kriya to the world in a new age, for the new age and for the whole world, choosing Master to bring it to the West, as the West is at that time, and still to a certain extent now, the place of nexus, place of much transfer of knowledge and information. This is why we see Kriya Yoga and Master's teachings being brought back to India. There's a whole level of people in India who are completely satisfied with what they are doing, and they're attaining realization and moksha, all these things, that's fine. But there's a level of Western educated people, probably, and that's what I've always thought. There's a certain number of them who can benefit by what he taught to the Western man in California when Master lived on this earth. He came to that place because it was a place of spreading ideas. Good ideas and bad ideas, but it is certainly a place much traveled to and much given much attention, especially during the times around Master's life and the succeeding decades after that. And Kriya Yoga is one of the tools. And it's, according to our guru lineage, Babaji says, this is the great tool. This is the great education, the great learning of something that can be used as a way of gaining emancipation. I'm often very moved thinking of Master, what he went through to bring this to us. And being given the authority and given the clear direction to come to the West. And he had much to go through, and some of it was very personal and very difficult. But he triumphed. He finished his work. And now it's left to us to continue. So what do we know from Ecclesiastes? Nothing new under the sun. But the one thing that we do know by stating it that way is that there's work to be done here. That there are ways out of this labyrinth. There are ways, in my more preferred language, of viewing this world in such a way that we recognize its limitations, its vanities, are just misunderstandings. They are all of the information that we have before us in the human sense, and we make judgments based on that. And then we're being taught that this man has been here, many, many men have been here for a long, long time, and this world has been a school for souls for a long, long time. Nothing new under the sun. But for each individual, these new things, these things can be new for that soul. They can be new to understand. We can't cling to them. Our memory of them will fade. But the experience will shape the form of our soul and force us, fit us to a body in Christ, a body focused on the salvation given to us by the Messiah, by the Christ within us. Sometimes when I read the Bible, I feel the futility of it in the way that it tells these stories, even starting with original sin, the constant mistakes that people make, that we all make. And there's a level of frustration. Now, some souls come here and they're ready for this. They've not got their fill. And they don't know that they're not the first person to have these thoughts or have these feelings. But those experiences formed them. They take the clay that was formed at the birth of their many incarnations in its more animalistic form and slowly fashion it into the higher man. And the higher man ultimately is formless, or the higher state that man can go into is formless. Man, by definition, is form. That's what humans are. We are form that is inhabited by the spirit. And we have to struggle through this. to gain our understanding, to get the knowledge of good and evil really clear, and to know that this is just a short stay here. Many lifetimes, many, many lifetimes, and a drop in the bucket of the time of God. But there's a salvation in the teachings that we get from the East. And these are buried in the Christian scriptures. But that is that time itself is not real. It is something imposed upon this world to make this world seem the way that it is. When we can step out of time, we can stop worrying about the issue of how long, O Lord, how long will this go on? Those of us on the last miles seem like we've been waiting a long time, and we simply just don't understand how much longer it's going to be. But time is the great prison warden. And when that is gone, we have then knowledge of real freedom. That's why so much emphasis is placed on the notion of fear. As long as we have fear of this realm, of this world, then we are trapped in the web of time and space. And one thing that most teachings don't address is the idea that the salvation, the solution, comes from giving up on those constraints. We think this time and space are the things that we have to do or deal with. That's all a house of mirrors. It simply is not true. It's timeless. There's no time. There's no space. But there's great, great joy. There is peace. There is rest. And there's interest in the self itself, in the self, creating new worlds. Does this go on and on? Now this is the approach to the great void, that it seems like it does go on and on, and then we have to ask, what's the point? We have to ask that. It's not a child's question. The point is existence itself. That we command all that we survey. You know, many times when I'm greatly uplifted, I come to this point where I see, or I seem to see, that nobody else is real. That they're only ideas. That only I exist. And that I is not the little I, but the notion of existence itself. Now, we can't get out of that. Existence is knowledge of bliss and peace. But there's a clue and it's difficult to describe. But bliss has no opposite. Joy and peace could have opposites. But bliss, correctly understood, has no opposite. And that's worth spending some time thinking about. What is the bliss that we really want, that will really satisfy us? What is this bliss that does that? We're taught so many different things, all of which are true. And we have to cling, during difficult times, we have to cling to one. And this is why Mother says, keep your mind on God. If there's one thing we can do, is we can blame God for everything. We can push anything else we want to on God. We can see Him as the source of all good things and bad things. But the great clue is to keep your mind on God. And then the house of mirrors doesn't collapse. It disappears. Doesn't become transparent. There's nothing outside the mirrors. We find that they're not real to begin with. How long, O Lord? If we don't have these questions and worries, we're probably not suited for this path. Mother always said that God will take you to Himself, even if you're fighting all the way. But it's certainly better to be a yogi and to learn not to react to any aggravation, anything that disturbs us. This is what yogis really offer us, is the ability to withstand with equanimity the things that we have to go through. We all have to go through it. We know of yogis who go through this, their life, and they seem to have no problems at all. But that's because they learned young to practice and to spend time with controlling the mind and controlling the body sufficiently to go through the trials that rock lesser people. So in a way, we can think of the yogic path as one just simply learning to withstand and to not be affected by time and space and the things of time and space, the ephemeral things that don't matter, but have such a punch in them. And the Greeks had the Stoics. That was a person who was unperturbed by anything that happened to them. Now that's a goal to get to for sure. And you can't, God will take sufficient interest in you to see if it really is stoicism or the pretense it's stoicism. This is why Mother talked about the crucifixion so much, is she knew that we were all, not just us by any means, but that if we really, she held out the path to the highest realization. And if you really want that, she wanted you to be aware that it was going to be made more difficult by latching on to the external world. And that to learn to keep your mind on God, to learn who we are, who the self really is. Now, something that we really must understand too is this thing of the Kundalini and the chemical and electrical things that occur in the body as part of this process. Excuse me. So it's important to recognize that we don't get there by strictly an intellectual or a mental process of difficulties in being a good stoic, in being a good yogi, as we imagine a good yogi is. A good yogi does withstand great difficulties. Stoics do. Great stoics have proven in the past. Great saints have. But they still have to deal with what the body has to perform. Mother said that even the angels must come down to the earth to gain final realization. That's because the process that occurs here is part of the undoing of the knots that we climbed to get to here. The other end of the string that we started from. We came down this pathway to where we are now deliberately. And we think, oh, how did we get out of this? How did I get myself into this? And the masters can you all hear me? How long did it just fade out for a minute?
I think you stopped. We lost you when you were saying that the angels have to come back down here because it's undoing the knot, something like that.
Right. Well, that's pretty recent then. That's good. Thank you for telling me that, for paying attention. Because it just went blank on this end. So.
Well, it said recording is stopped. And then a minute later, or a second later, it said recording is in progress.
Oh, very strange. Yeah. We heard the recording it started, but we didn't hear the recording is stopped. Interesting. Oh, well. God's saying enough, Larry. Give it a rest.
They've all been stoics long enough.
Right. You're teaching them stoicism. That's great. Okay, but there's only so much you can do. What did some of you think of the Ecclesiastes when you heard the whole chapter? Anybody have any comments on that?
Could I share one thing that God had me think of when you read the chapter?
Yeah.
It was nothing new under the sun.
Right. And
how that could pertain to our Kriya practice. And if the sun is the Ajna point, is that right?
That's right.
Metaphysically, the sun is the light of God at the Ajna. So when the life force and consciousness, reaches the sun, you said that, anything new can only come from the spirit. So when that life force and consciousness reaches that light of God and touches that light of God and enters that light of God, that's something new. Now there's something new. But under the sun, all through the circulating through all the rest of the body and the energy centers, that there is nothing new on under the sun. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. That's the way Mother always thought, too. I don't remember that her saying that about this, but that's a perfect understanding of how Mother taught and how Mother thought about allegory and metaphysical teachings. And that makes a lot of sense, because under the sun. Well, I've certainly always said, David and I talked about this many times too, that one thing is kind of a mark of a great saint is the surprise that comes with. And because they really do think, and David's latter, years, decades, was full of surprises and new, something new that he was coming and bringing down to us. And Mother was always like that. She was never predictable. I suppose, too, the teachings are trying to say, don't think that you've come from for some special reason that's unique in the world, but rather you're part of a process of God living his life through many people, and that there's a point where people must return. And that those people are then taught that nothing is new, that all the things you think are so important, it's just all vanities, is really just meaning that think higher than that. It's not just what you think it is here at all.
The part that really jumped out at me was the more wisdom you have, the more suffering you have. I meant probably not quoting it exactly right.
Right. Yeah, that connection with knowledge. Oops, there it is. That connection with knowledge, and I should probably read that again, but you're right. That that's a vanity.
Yeah.
Knowledge doesn't give you anything. Let me read that. That's a really good point, Michelle.
It just jumped out at me.
Yeah. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Wow, that's tough medicine. Well, there's a difference between knowledge of God, gnosis or jnani in the Eastern Indian way, but and knowledge of the world. One is vertical and it's operating in the vertical in knowledge of God. And the other is horizontal in its knowledge of the things in the world, the material reality.
And that's where the vanity comes in, isn't it? Because
yeah.
There's nothing new.
Right.
So if you keep in, you know, you're adding other bits of knowledge, so you think. And yet if there's nothing new under that greatness that is God, then that's where the vanity comes in. Yet at the same time, we hear that God is ever new. So if we are one with God, then all is ever new.
Mm-hmm.
But without Him, it's not new, it's all vanity.
It's interesting to think, though, that to evaluate God in your own life, too, as being something that takes you aback, that surprises you, that's a mark of spiritual attainment, but also it's a mark of touching closer to God. We should be surprised. And that's really where the joy comes from. Is that sense of newness.
But the grief and the suffering comes from being attached to things of the world and ideas of the world. And
right. And not even knowledge of the world. Being a real expert in something.
Yeah.
Won't bring that to you. It'll bring you nothing.
I always think that if you learn enough, like, then you can conquer the world. Like, if you learn enough about your health, then you can eat all the right things and live a long life. But it's really not true. It's an illusion.
Well, implicit in what you just said, it's saying that living a long life is what we're all about. Well, that's not true. We should be respectful of the body. We shouldn't be disrespectful, but no, the goal is to know God. And that can happen at 10 years old just as easily as at 80.
Yeah.
And whether you're an expert or not, so yeah.
I just like to read a lot of medical things, and sometimes it's just like almost like an addiction.
Yeah, that's true. And there's so much pride associated with it, but yeah, there's also just that curiosity. All of those are things that will cause you moving horizontally. You have to move in the horizontal plane, the physical plane, to get that information, to become knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And to even be good at it, to be good in the world, to do what we think is good, but to be good and effective in the world. All of those things are vanities. And then we also are told, you know, look at Babaji said, you were chosen to come to me after you were married. I want you in the world. So we know that this is important. But Ecclesiastes is talking to people, talking to the higher elements, people leaving perhaps for the last lifetime or at least completing some cycle, some portion of it. To give up knowledge of this plane. It seems so important.
I like the saying from Plato that all knowledge is remembering.
Mm.
Does that ring a bell to you? I remember that many, many years ago, and I found that quite wonderful and fascinating because we're remembering who we are little bit by little bit.
And we've all done this before. If it's not I have done it, someone like me has done it.
Yeah.
So it is memory in that sense for sure. The species itself is remembering, constantly reliving and remembering.
Mm-hmm.
But even that kind of fruitless notion is an illusion of time. We shouldn't cling to it. It's a difficult thing to do, to not think in terms of time. It isn't probably possible to do so, but certainly one can give up on the constraining elements of time, the things that give you fear and remorse too, but fear of the future, remorse for things in the past. These are things that really get their claws into you. These are hard things to do. Because we are, like the Hiram Hasya, we're enmeshed in this world for a reason. Mm-hmm. We don't have to be as great as he was. He was a fully realized master. He said that he had nothing, no karma of his own. Prabhupada said.
May I share one other thing that I thought of the Ecclesiastes reading?
What he's
describing, it sounds like what sets people on the spiritual path when you've kind of been down this road and that road, everything in life that you think will satisfy you. And then you realize, like, what is the point? Why am I here? There's, you know, we all just live and work and have fun and then we die and that's it. Is there really nothing more? And that's what sets people in, you know, aspiring for that higher consciousness, when that realization, when that burning question comes, you know, when you go inside your heart, like, can't remember his wording, but it was very beautiful how he said he was in conversation, in his own heart, and he got everything that his own heart desired, but still it didn't satisfy him. So it's like when you have that question, hold that question in your heart, and that's what's all that's left is God is the only, the only answer after that.
Well, you don't have God. You think this is where depression and suicides come from, isn't it? Because we get, for some reason, God's given us the gift of himself to us who follow a religious path and work with the idea of God even. Is a more beneficial place to be than to be taught the opposite of that. I think in a way, it's a cruel punishment to teach children that there's, of an atheistic point of view. Only in that perspective, I know there's lots of people who do well in the world, but ultimately, without God, it becomes this prison and this place that makes no sense, that you don't want to live for. I have not, you are completely alienated from all around you without the notion of God and without a notion of the divine element of our own selves. That's why they say there's no atheists in foxholes. As a general rule, there's so much truth to that, because it's saying that when things get really difficult, we reach out to anything. We reach out in directions that we would never have done so. The idea of somebody praying to God, they're so desperate they would pray. You know, that's quite a realization to come to that point. We live in such a little niche of time that, and again, it's only in certain places in the world. There's much difficulty all over the world, but we live in a time where we can live fairly good lives and fairly safe lives and not have any reason to call to God. But it's a dry world too.
Like when your son got lost at Seattle Center.
I was so scared I prayed to God.
Yeah.
Isn't that just a simple statement of his mental state, isn't it?
Yeah. Suppose the people that have something that they need to do this lifetime, that is, they're in the time in their lifetimes, they have something on the material plane to achieve. And at least at that time when they're producing the things or they're creating something, all is not vanity. But they too will get to that point in this lifetime or another lifetime, maybe as they're dying or maybe another time, when it's so clear what, you know, what Rebecca was saying, when all of us have gone through that, saying, what is this life? Why are we here? Is there not more to this? But I suppose those that have chosen to come into an atheist lifetime, perhaps they have just something to do like that.
Well, there's great deep disappointment in other lives lived with, in a religious way too.
Mm-hmm.
Could easily be a reaction.
Mm-hmm. Reaction to that, yeah.
I think these gatherings on Wednesday give us the bird's eye view again. I think it's just so wonderful because we're able to return to that high vantage point. It's really valuable. Mm.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, just to discuss this?
Mm-hmm. So easy to forget. We need reminders every single day, all through the day. You know, we need to see that big picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see our closing prayer. I was thinking of how these prayers, for me, I don't mean to be trite here, but there's a Pavlovian aspect with all things we do in a ritual sense. These prayers I always find, even beforehand I don't feel it, but while we're saying them, it puts me in mind of Mother and being with Mother. It makes me realize she did this every time for a reason. And so, I have faith that she knows what she's doing. And I feel it. It brings me into a mood faster than almost any other thing we can do. So I'm not saying this to make everybody think, well, we've got to say these prayers and we really have to mean them. But we can work on that. We can say, boy, these prayers Mother wrote and brought forth, they're very powerful. But the fact of saying something that we say together and that we say every time we get together in this mode, very powerful. It can be so. Ritual has its place. Okay, just pray with me, oh Heavenly Father.
Oh Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Oh.